topic of today's lecture is to look at a few applications of scientific principles of performance measurement in the practice of performance measurement. The practice of performance measurement is a very important element of the management of human resources in organization. It also, the performance measurement activities also correspond to the middle of the life cycle of employment relationship that we're studying in this course. We looked at hiring, selection. Now we're talking about incentives. In order to do incentives, you need to evaluate performance. In the end of the course, we'll be talking about how to end an employment relationship and talk about employee turnover. But now, everybody is still in, nobody wants to leave, everybody wants to hear feedback about their performance evaluation, all that much more, to the extent that this feedback partly determines the amount of bonus, career progression, or other perks that come with the job. So here's an example of an evaluation form. It's an actual, the real evaluation form used by a firm called Burger King. Now, so can you see the principles of performance evaluation at work? So looking at this form, can you sort of make sense of it? Why it's constructed the way it is constructed? And is there other principles of performance evaluation at work? And what are these principles? So, it's performance review and merit increase time again. This is the first sentence that that is there on this performance evaluation form. So people's attention is focused to the purpose for which performance evaluation is done. And that's quite right, because you do performance evaluation in order to make HR decisions, right? And of course, the most relevant HR decision to the workers is a decision about what to do with their career, with their wage, whether or not should get a bonus, how high a bonus they should get. And in order to substantiate the decisions about career and bonuses, performance evaluation input is needed, and here we are. You have to provide information that will feed into the system of HR decision making that will determine your career chances. So, but the main part of performance evaluation is this. Now, look here, you have to rate your own performance yourself, and you also have to get your manager rate your performance, right? Now, why do you need, why is it implemented the way it is implemented, right? Why is this implemented? Why is it not only manager, for instance, right? Why is it not customers? Why is it both self and manager? Well, it's good practice. It's good practice to have more than one performance evaluators, right? Why is it good practice to have to have more than one performance evaluators? Well, especially when it comes to when it comes to any performance measurement, which is of course a very noisy business, especially when this performance measurement proceeds over indicators that do not have a clear physical manifestation. For example, demonstrates high ethical standards or delivers excellent service or even more subjectively takes initiative. How do you measure take initiative? In euros, meters, or kilograms, right? So there are a lot of performance indicators that don't have clear way to measure them physically, and so the noisiness of this measure is considerable. And of course, we don't want to have a lot of noise in our performance measures, because if there's a lot of noise in performance measures, you have to compensate for this noise by offering more substantial risk premium. This is the monitoring intensity principle. So you want to have as accurate a performance measure as possible. And one relatively cheap way of increasing the accuracy of performance measure is to have more than one performance evaluators. Because the noise with which different performance evaluators measure the performance of a particular individual or organizational unit, these noise term in a large number of circumstances tend to partly cancel each other. right? Especially here, right? When you measure self and when you get your manager to measure your performance. Now, you may have a good predisposition towards yourself and you can rank yourself very highly on all of these indicators because you know that it's, you know, you're being strategic and you know that it will determine your career progression. So there's going to be noise, both noise and bias in your own performance evaluation. Now, to cancel part of this bias and this noise, you need to have a manager evaluate you. And then there will be an agreement procedure between the two rankings, typically the average or weighted average, which will enter into your performance file, and based on which information your bonus will be determined. Now, so the monitoring intensity principle dictates, having, if possible, more than one evaluators in practical situations. We will get back to this very important principle, the monitoring intensity principle, when we study the so-called 360 degree feedback, which is a sort of it's a catchy term. It's used in the practice of HR management and in the sort of Fach literature in HR management very, very often. Now, what is it really? It's about having different evaluators looking at your performance at different angles, hence this analogy with geometry, 360 degree feedback. It's really the practical implementation, a popular practical implementation of the monitoring intensity principle. So, what do we also see? We see that there's more than one criterion for evaluation, right? So the performance, your performance is evaluated not in terms of one indicator, which is what we see in the classical model of incentive pay. There's just one output, Y. It's not multidimensional. Later on, when we talk about the alignment principle, we allow different measures of performance to enter the bonus equation simultaneously. In fact, in many practical situations, I would say in most practical situations, performance outcomes are multidimensional. That's why you need more than one criterion for performance evaluation. So it's not only whether you take initiative or not. It's also about service. It's also about high standards, and it's also about executing against priorities, whatever it means. You know, there's quite a lot of jargon in this evaluation forms, which is quite unhelpful. The point I wanted to make is the use of multiple criteria for performance evaluation. Now, this is consistent with the informativeness principle. What does the informativeness informativeness principle say? The informativeness principle says that you should use every available measure of performance which is either correlated with your effort. Right, so that's what all these performance measures do. They're all correlated with your effort, which is potentially multidimensional, but doesn't even have to be multidimensional. Or another class of useful performance indicators are the indicators that may not be related to your effort, but are related to the noise that is added to your effort in the performance function. So to cancel this noise, to isolate part of this noise, you may use these class of performance indicators. Remember the relative performance evaluation story from the last lecture. This does exactly this cancellation of noise trick. Now, the cancellation of noise story through using indicators that, while unrelated to your own effort, are related to the noise to your effort, leads me to remarking on the next scientific principle of performance evaluation, which is the, informativeness and the alignment principle, right? So absolute as well as relative performance evaluation, the use of absolute as well as relative performance evaluation criteria weeds out common shocks to performance and allows to align through multiple performance indicators. It allows to get a measure of performance, an aggregate measure of performance, which could be more aligned to what the organization really wants, more aligned than the use of single or very few performance indicators, however precisely they may be measured. So you have, well, look, these are the descriptions of the standards, of performance standards that correspond to each of the performance grade, right? So this thing does two. This description serves two purposes. One is to introduce an element of relative performance evaluation. Where do you see the element of relative performance evaluation? You see it in the description, you see it quite clearly in the description of the grade standards. For instance, the grade 3 meets expectations. So it sort of links the performance at grade 3 to the sort of expected average acceptable standard level of how things should be done at Burger King. So if you just meet the standards, if you are on ballpark with your colleagues and in fact the organizational standards, you get a grade 3. Now, if you go above expectation, if your performance is better than the standard, you get a grade 4. If it's way above the standard, then you get a grade 5. But there is always a standard. There is always a reference to some sort of aggregate performance level, the standard, the yardstick, if you like, performance level that brings in an element of relative performance evaluation. Now, the second purpose that this grade description serves is the purpose of increasing the precision of performance evaluation by giving a sense of measure to indicators that do not easily lend themselves to objective physical measurement, right? So how can you assess to what extent you take initiative, right? So some people might say, okay, take initiative, let's give 2 out of 5. Other people might say, oh, let's give 4 out of 5. Why not 5 out of 5 after all? I mean, it's my own subjective, right? It's my own subjective way of looking at the extent to which person takes initiative or not. Now, of course, this would have been a really badly designed performance evaluation scheme. Why would it be so badly designed? Because it introduces a considerable element of noise and imprecision, which has to do with subjective translation of performance standards and the grades on the scale, right? So in some, for some people, no punishment is reward enough. So some people can be really stingy with their evaluations. Other people can be quite generous with their evaluation. And when the performance criterion cannot be physically assessed, then it's really helpful to do what's in the literature called behavioral ranking, behavioral anchoring. So behavioral anchoring. We will look at the behaviorally anchored ranking scales later on in the lecture, and that's an example of behavioral anchoring. You give a short description of the sort of standard of performance that corresponds to a particular grade. This disciplines individuals in assessing their performance. This gives behavioral clues and maybe sometimes even examples that help people decide whether they should give 2, 3, or 4 for a performance indicator that cannot be measured in euros or kilograms. So there's a lot of science in performance evaluation, in the practice of performance evaluation, even when it comes to evaluating performance of, who are these? These are people who work in Burger King shops. So these are the entry-level employees in the organization. And things get more complicated and more scientific and more expensive and more nuanced as you move up the hierarchical levels in many organizations which pay a lot of attention to performance measurement and use this as input into incentivizing and motivating their employees. So, and that's what we're going to do with this lecture. We're going to try and apply what we've learned about scientific principles of performance evaluation to thinking, often critically thinking, about how the practice of performance evaluation is carried out in real firms. So, performance metrics in practice. Let's just briefly review the different types of performance metric. So what is a performance metric? It's a criterion. It's the measure that you use to evaluate the performance of your employees. Now, performance metrics can be quantitative. That's the best performance metric you can have. It's physically measurable. You can measure it in euros or other physical units. Now, unfortunately, these quantitative or physical performance metrics are not widely available. They are expensive to get. And what's even worse, they may not fully reflect the full complexity of contributions of employees to organizational performance. So think about sales versus customer service. Sales can be physically measured, but what organization wants is some sort of bundle between sales effort and customer service effort, which is hard to capture using sales indicators alone. Now, so that's why firms often have recourse to subjective performance metrics. So subjective performance metrics, it's performance metrics that are not physical in nature. They rely on people using their cognitive facilities to make sense of the behavior of themselves or their colleagues or their subordinates and convert this impression into some numerical scale, which is what we saw just here. So most of the performance measures in practice are actually subjective, and that makes it very interesting, and that makes it also very difficult because of all sorts of noise and bias involved in the measurement of performance using subjective metrics. Now, sometimes the two are conflated, so you can have a subjective performance metric which has a physical measure to it. In accounting, there is a term called goodwill. So if you look at the balance of firms, right, then there is an entry. Often there's an entry called goodwill. Now, what is goodwill, right? Is it the amount of stuff that you have in your warehouse? Is it the amount of sales that you've generated in the past month? Is it the number of employees that you employ? Is it your wage budget that you're given? No, goodwill is not physical. Goodwill, as according to the definition, is, what is the definition of goodwill? I don't remember the accounting definition of goodwill, but the idea is that it's basically the quantitative, the financial measure of the quality of relationship with suppliers or creditors that this firm is enjoying. Right, quite how you measure goodwill. There are thick books about how to measure goodwill, but this is not something physical. This is something that firms record and convert into cash, but it does not have clear physical manifestation. It's basically how friendly you think you are with your suppliers. It's basically how many days they are prepared to wait before you make a payment on the deliveries that they've made to you. It's also, talking about creditors, it's a financial measure of the attractiveness of financial conditions like interest rates or other payment terms that they're prepared to give you while financing your current business operations. So it's subjective, and yet it has some physical quantification in terms of the amount of cash that in terms of the amount of euros that you put under the goodwill heading on accounting balance. Now, this is a classification of performance metrics in terms of how they can be measured in physical terms or in more subjective terms. Now, performance metrics can also be divided into individual-based and group-based. So an individual-based performance metric is the performance metric that evaluates the performance of a particular individual, right? Group-based is a performance metric that evaluates the performance of a group. So these are all individual-based performance metrics, right? But there can also be group-based performance metrics, right? So, and both individual as well as group-based performance metrics can be both quantitative and subjective, right? You can think about sales that were generated by a particular group of employees together. So that would give you a quantitative group-based performance metric, right? You can think of sales generated by individual worker. You can think about customer service, subjective customer service generated by a group of employees. You can think about customer service delivered by individual workers. Now, performance metrics can be absolute versus relative. So the absolute performance metric ranks the performance subjective or objective, of either individual or group in some sort of absolute sense, without reference to any standard or any benchmark. So what is my performance? What is the average student evaluation for personnel economics course in this semester? It's 2.08, I think, or 2. I forgot. Let's say 2, right? So this is not with any reference. This is not supposed to be with any reference to the sort of average standard of performance that is enjoyed by students at the University of Constance. At least it's not supposed to be. Of course, people can't help comparing some courses with other courses, but at least the idea is for this performance metric to be absolute, right? Now, performance metrics can also be relative. That's, when you evaluate performance explicitly, it's written in the description of either performance grade or in the description of performance indicator itself, it's written that you should evaluate the performance in relation or in comparison with the performance of a certain benchmark group. So that's a sort of one way to classify the large number of performance metrics used in practice. So let's look at quantitative versus subjective performance evaluation. Now, one idea that I want you to take away from this course is that, you know, if you can measure performance in a physical quantitative way, do so. It will not reflect all the inputs that people deliver to organizations, but quantitative performance evaluation is actually the best measure of performance in terms of the precision that you can achieve and in terms of the objectiveness involved in the execution of performance evaluation process, right? So, but there are problems, of course, and the one problem that we have started talking about, I think, several lectures ago when we looked at, when we look at performance-based incentive schemes when effort is not reserved, is that if you have a quantitative performance measure, it does not immediately tell you exactly how much effort a person has or a unit has spent on delivering this performance outcome. Because any performance measure, objective or subjective, is always a function of the effort that has been spent on delivering this performance outcome, as well as the noise that enters into this performance, either in additive way, which is what we've seen in the course, or it can also enter the performance measure in a multiplicative way, which is actually a very realistic scenario, but mathematically much more involved, so we sort of don't treat it in this course. Now, of course, you may remember from previous lectures that in case of quantitative performance evaluation, you could implement the first best contract under two circumstances, either when you have a perfect measure of performance, which is basically in which the noise is zero, or when you're dealing with risk-neutral people, risk-neutral workers, and, you know, both these situations are highly unlikely to happen in reality. So the problem is when true effort is unmeasurable, right, or not perfectly measurable, how do you measure performance? Especially how do you measure performance in practice? So there are solutions, and this slide is actually, there isn't much new on this slide. It's just a repetition of the previous ideas that we have voiced to sort of come together with the performance evaluation practices used by firms. Now, what firms do actually, they reward actual performance. They often write contracts, incentive contracts, where actual performance objectively measured is the criterion against which promotion and pay decisions are made. There are also a few noise cancellation tricks, and examples are before you. So you could use group level outputs. Group level performance indicators are good because you can measure a lot more, you can measure group performance in a lot more cases than you can measure individual performance, simply because most of the tasks in the modern organizations are carried out by groups. And if you have a task or performance indicator which has been created by group effort, and as I said, most of the tasks and performance indicators are created by group, it's unclear how you determine the individual contribution of group members. It's most of the time impossible. So you either have recourse to subjective and unreliable measures of performance, or you use group performance indicators, which are much more reliable, but then it's group with all these interesting implications with respect to free riding and strategic behaviors of individuals within the group, much more of which we will tell in the we will talk about in the second part of the course. Now, you could do relative performance evaluation. That's what we've seen. We've seen how it works. We've seen how it works before. It cancels the noise. And whatever practice you use to cancel the noise in performance measure is beneficial, is great. Why? Because you can design sharper incentives based on clearer performance measures, and people will put in more effort if they know that their performance is measured precisely. Now, so another alternative that we have not yet considered is to measure and reward not outputs, not performance outcomes, which are measured with noise, but inputs into the work process, which are not, which can often be measured a lot better, right? So sales is a function of effort plus noise, right? So and that creates all these implications that are interesting for us, especially when the agent is risk averse. Now, how about measuring inputs into the production process? How about rewarding per hour of work, right? So that's input, that's not yet output. The advantage here is that you can measure work hours very, very precisely. This is physical measure of input that can be recorded and can be verified should there be a dispute about pay or something. You know, people are paid by the hour. It's a popular practice. People are paid by the hour. And time, working time, is recorded in very precisely in many organizations. You may have seen, even in the University of Konstanz, you may have seen little card reading machines, right? The employees come and insert their cards or transponders into these machines, and that's how the system knows whether they are in the building or not. And that's how their working hours are calculated, and you can, you know, then decide how many hours you've got and see how much you can take out for leave or other things. So the measuring and rewarding inputs in production process, such as working hours, is a very popular alternative to using noisy performance measures of output, of performance outcomes. Well, a couple of problems there. Well, first of all, there are lots of inputs, and exactly which input you take and exactly which input you reward and to what extent is a problem. Not unlike the problem of determining the weights of different performance indicators in the total. Recall the alignment principle of performance evaluation last lecture. Now, another problem here is, of course, there can be a great deal of moral hazard in the business of measuring and rewarding inputs into the production process rather than outcomes, because agents are much more free to manipulate their inputs in the production process than performance outcomes. It's very easy to game the system when you are paid by the hour. You know, you check in, that's how your pay time starts, and then you watch YouTube clips or surf your Facebook or play office golf or whatever. Your time is ticking. You're paid. Everybody's thinking that your performance is measured super precisely, so they can divide super sharp incentives based on the hours that you work. And you do get lots of money based on the hours that you work, because you're always there. But at the end of the day, what is the organizational outcome? Well, it's affected. By the extent to which you've used this time productively versus watching YouTube clips, which is a lot harder to measure than just working hours. Now, so another, I would say group of solutions to the problem of imprecise measurement is to use more than one evaluator and using more than one performance indicators. So the business of using more than one evaluator comes under the heading 360-degree feedback. And the business of using lots of performance indicators has a special jargon name in the business literature. And when you go to work in organizations, I'm sure chances are you will hear it many, many times. This is called the balanced scorecard. So the practical implementation of the theory that you should use more than one performance indicators is called the balanced scorecard approach. So it's basically, it's a big table looking something like this. It's a big table that lists all the performance indicators that the firm is interested in, right? So it lists all the performance indicators that the firm is interested in. It gives you a clear mental picture of what's important for the organization. Now, often it gives the targets, but the targets are optional. You may or may not have the target, depending on how your incentives are designed. Many incentive schemes, as we learned from the targets lecture, many incentive schemes are designed with performance targets, and there are good reasons for having performance targets, that you can increase the efficiency of incentive contracts by avoiding the limited liability constraint if you set the target at the right level. But that's optional. So you have the descriptions of performance indicators. You need these descriptions because many of these performance indicators are either subjective, or even when they are objective, there is quite a complicated way of measuring them. How do you measure goodwill? As I said, there are thick books written about how to measure goodwill. You need to describe how these things are measured. So optional targets, and here, there may or may not be suggestions, the communications from the firm suggesting certain initiatives or certain ways to follow, to implement, to achieve the desired performance outcomes. So basically, this balanced scorecard approach advocates the use of many, many different performance indicators, bringing them together in one table, describing them, optionally setting the target depending on what sort of incentives you practice, what your business strategy is, and that, you know, I don't the there are a lot of studies praising the balanced scorecard approach, but there are not so many empirical studies. There isn't so much empirical evidence that would convincingly show the superior performance of balanced scorecard approach versus other ways of measuring and codifying and communicating performance outcomes. It's very, very hard. But the best practice today in HR management when it comes to performance measurement is to use balanced scorecard. So, and that of course speaks to the informativeness principle very, very directly. The informativeness principle says you should use all performance indicators available to evaluate organizational performance, and only then will you make the most of the information, imperfect, noisy, but still not uninformative data based on which you can design incentives and evaluate performance. So another way to reduce the noise in performance is to use multiple raters. And what's the idea there? Recall the beginning of the lecture, we were talking about the Burger King evaluation, we were talking about the self-evaluation versus manager evaluation, right? This is a sort of the simplest sort of prototypical 360-degree feedback. It's not 360-degree feedback. It's more like 90 or 180-degree feedback, but it doesn't matter. What matters is that you use more than one performance evaluators to evaluate performance. Why? Because this way you can partly cancel the noise in individual performance evaluations as well as the bias that different performance evaluators or raters, as they are called in the industrial psychology literature, may have. So to use multiple raters and to make the most of the imperfect information available to measure performance, the literature recommends thinking about the right format of evaluation and selecting the right raters. right? So, and this requires understanding how subjective, cognitive, individual efforts to make sense of the very complex picture of the production process through which individual effort results in a multitude of performance outcomes, how this process works and what sort of imperfections and biases this cognitive effort creates. Because all these imperfections and biases in capturing effort inputs and, you know, capturing the relationship between efforts and performance outcomes is going to enter as the unwelcome noise term in the precious performance indicators that firms will use later on. So, let's look at subjective performance evaluation formats. So now we're in the world of having to relate, of having to rely on multiple raters, right? We need to rely on multiple raters in the absence of clear, objectively measurable, and perfectly verifiable measures of performance. Now we're trying to measure things like friendliness, things like customer service, things like quality of teaching in some abstract sense. We have to use multiple raters. Now, and for that, we need to select the right performance evaluation format. Now, there are two popular choices when it comes to the evaluation format. One is rating, and the other one is ranking. So rating and ranking, there's the two different options that firms can use to facilitate subjective performance evaluations procedures. So what is rating? Rating is giving a grade between 1 and 5 or 1 and 10, doesn't matter. You're giving a grade to a particular aspect of performance on an absolute scale. Sometimes you are helped by using anchors, which give you descriptions of behaviors that correspond to a particular grade. So you have been already quite experienced raters, because each time you study a course at this university, you have an evaluation form, and there you have to rate your professor's performance along a variety of dimensions. Now, there are no behavioral descriptions of the grades, and that, I think, is a deficiency. But that's sort of an example that everybody of you should immediately have before in their head when thinking about rating. Rating is giving evaluations to your course professor, and it's evaluating performance on an absolute scale, often with the help of anchors, the short descriptions of behaviors corresponding to a particular grade. Now, the second popular choice of subjective performance evaluation format is ranking. So ranking is interesting. Ranking is not rating. You don't give grades you don't give grades evaluating absolute performance. You choose, you rank individuals that are part of the evaluation process you rank these individuals along possibly a number of different criteria. So you could have straight ranking, basically rank these people in this department in terms of their contribution to the departmental output, starting with number one and ending with the last. You can have alternation ranking. You first choose the best, then you choose the worst, second best, second worst, etc. Or you could use paired comparison ranking, when you rank each person in pairs with the rest. Now, these different ways of ranking are there in order to reduce the bias and inconsistency that people might have when they rank. The business of ranking can actually be quite difficult when the number of criteria is large, and especially when the number of individuals is large. Imagine you have a group of, 100 people. You need to rank them between 1 and 100. You may have a good idea about who number one is and who number 100 is. You know, the best and worst performance are naturally sort of sticking out. But, you know, how about rank 56 versus rank 57? How about rank 66 versus rank 23? Yeah. So it's less easy to you know, to rank people in the middle of the distribution. And in order to facilitate the business of ranking people in the, especially in the middle of the distribution, some sources in the industrial psychology literature recommend some you know, props and helps in the ranking process. Now, when to use ranking and when to use rating? Well, both ranking and rating have their advantages and disadvantages. The sort of the easy way to distinguish between these two: rating is used when you're not interested in relative performance evaluation, but when you're interested in absolute performance evaluation, then you use rating. Ranking is used when you're interested in relative performance evaluation. Why should you be interested in relative performance evaluation? Well, because relative performance evaluation, as we know from the informativeness principle from the last lecture, relative performance evaluation can generate stronger incentives by getting rid of some of the noise to performance indicators. To the extent to which individual noise terms to individual performance indicators are correlated, you can measure individual performance with reference to the group average performance or any sort of benchmark performance that you may choose, and then part of the noise will be cancelled. It's quite a statistical mathematical argument that we presented last lecture. So a relative performance evaluation is great, and everybody should do relative performance evaluation. However, it's not true that everybody should necessarily do relative performance evaluation, by the way, because the relative performance evaluation relies on a particular benchmark. And what is the benchmark? How to generate the benchmark? Why this particular performance indicator, why this particular reference group should be the benchmark group, are individual and very interesting questions that do not really have general treatment in the literature. So relative performance evaluation is great when you can find the suitable benchmark group. When you can't do that, then you have to have recourse to absolute performance evaluation. Now, to facilitate absolute performance evaluation, a very good practice is to use what's called behaviorally anchored rating scales. Behaviorally anchored rating scales. I already mentioned BARS. Here, look, this is a practical implementation of behaviorally anchored rating scales. You're not only asked to give a grade between 1 and 5, you are helped by being given a description of behaviors and performance standards that correspond to each individual grade. So that's what BARS is doing, right? So it's a very, very frequently used format. And why it's there, what's the reason for using BARS, is to reduce the subjectivism and bias in performance rating. Right? So in the absence of physically measurable outcomes, there is a lot of bias, there's a lot of noise to try and reduce it, to try and make different raters' outputs consistent with each other. You want to anchor them to particular standards of behaviors that would be common to all the raters. So BARS is a great thing. Now let me show you a couple of examples that illustrate the importance of BARS, not only in the business of producing meaningful performance indicators, but also, and more importantly, in linking these performance indicators to organizational performance. So a couple of examples. Here's an example from a study that I did together with my supervisor when I was a PhD student at University of Birmingham in England, Stan Siebert. We had access to a very large retail network selling shoes in Britain and worldwide. So, lots of shops, and each shop was managed by a shop manager. And the firm had a regular performance assessment exercise based on the results of which shop managers were promoted or demoted or and would get their bonus or would not get their bonus. So this was a very, very important thing, determining not only career prospects of shop managers, but also their current income. And this was implemented not unlike the Burger King story. You had different performance indicators called key performance indicators in the case of our study firm. And they were behavioral descriptions of each of the performance grade. And they also implemented multiple raters. In particular, the shop manager would have to rate themselves. And then this rating would have to be also, a second rating would have to be given by the regional manager, which is the next level of organizational hierarchy. Now, why is this such a great performance assessment exercise? Well, look, these are key performance indicators, the performance outcomes that the firm considers to be important. And there are grades. There are three grades. There's grade capable, there's grade strength, and there's a grade development need, which also has a description, but for the lack of space, it's somewhere here. So as you can see, each grade has a very detailed description. And so each manager and regional manager would receive a brochure describing each of the grades and, you know, telling them, please consider the performance of yourself or the manager X who is reporting to you and try to rate their performance along these key performance indicators using the grade descriptions as precisely as you possibly can. So this is BARS used very, very, very seriously, right? And what we see that people differ, shop managers differ in terms of their key behavioral indicators. There are some people who are not so good. There are some people who are quite good, right? And most of the people are in between. Okay. Why should we be so excited about it? We should be excited about it because this is actually a meaningful performance measure, right? It's a meaningful performance measure. Why is this a meaningful performance measure? It's a valid performance measure because it's correlated with objective performance indicators that actually determine the bottom line, that actually determine the profits and market share of this organization. So look, if you're a bad manager, according to a particular performance measure, you will end up managing a smaller shop. It's smaller not only in terms of employees, but also in terms of space. You will be earning less money, right? And you will be selling less stuff per hour worked in your shop, right? If you're a good manager, you'll be managing a larger shop, you'll be earning more money, and you'll be selling more per hour worked in your shop. So there is a correlation between subjective performance indicators and objective measures of shop's performance. Why am I so excited about this correlation? Because don't forget what these performance measures are used for. These performance measures are used to reward shop managers, right? If these performance measures have nothing to do with how well they're doing financially, then the question is, what is it that you're rewarding, right? On which basis do you make decisions which are very important for the welfare of your managers, which may actually lead to some managers leaving your organizations and other managers being promoted, other managers being demoted? What is it that you're promoted for, right? You're promoted based on sales focus and commercial awareness, but do these performance measures actually manifest themselves in a meaningful way in hard performance outcomes? And the answer is yes. So this performance measure is what's called externally valid. It's not only internally consistent, because different grades have different descriptions. It's also externally valid in the sense that it's correlated with some physical performance outcome, which is important for the firm. You could ask me a question saying, oh, well, if you're so excited about performance measures being correlated with physical outcomes, why don't you use physical outcomes as the only performance measure to reward shop managers' performance? And I would say, good question. I largely agree with you. However, if you reward people based on a narrowly defined performance outcome such as sales, then by alignment principle, think about the alignment principle, the managers would concentrate only on the activities that generate sales today. And what are the activities that generate sales today? These are the activities that are not necessarily conducive to to long-term success of an organization, which is achieved through keeping shops in good form and being nice with customers and practicing high standards of operations. In order to capture these performance outcomes, using profits is not enough. You have to use key behavioral indicators. Now, when you use key behavioral indicators, you have to make sure that they are externally valid in the sense that they are related, that they are meaningfully measured and are related to physical performance outcomes. So this is a very good system of performance evaluation that I would advocate for the use by other organizations. Now, here's an example of a badly done performance evaluation. And this example comes from, it's real data. It comes from another firm, this time in Germany. It's a network of bakeries. And they do, as many retailers do, it's a common practice in the retail business called mystery shopping. Have you heard of mystery shopping? Mystery shopping is when you're a mystery customer, you are an employee of some marketing agency or maybe an employee in the headquarters of the firm. You get, say, 15 euros. You come to a shop, you buy something in that shop. You don't say that I've come to evaluate your performance, hence the word mystery, right? So you come to buy something in the shop incognito. Then, as you leave the shop, you open your little record book and you quickly evaluate the performance of the salespeople in the shop, how friendly they are, how knowledgeable they are, whether they were wearing uniform or not, whether they greeted you, whether they offered you something else. You evaluate how clean the shop is, etc., etc. So this is a practice that is considered one of the key practices of performance evaluation in the retail sector, right? I don't know any retail organization that I've come across, and I've come across a few. I don't know any retail organization that wouldn't be doing mystery shopping. So mystery shopping seems to be a great practice of performance evaluation. However, in this particular case, in the particular case of this bakery, this performance evaluation practice did not have a bars. It didn't have behaviorally anchored rating scales, right? So mystery shoppers were asked to rate, you know, the cleanliness of the shop, the sales effort of employees, the presence of fresh bread on the shelves, and the overall impression. So that's what these variables in the stata output mean, right? So they were just asked to rank on the scale between 1 and 5 how friendly the salespeople were, how clean the store was, etc. But no behavioral descriptions, no descriptions of what it means to have a grade 2 versus grade 4, right? Now, what we have as a result is that look here. All these performance indicators are on average quite close to 100%. So on average, all shops are super excellent in terms of cleanliness, customer service, the presence of fresh products, etc., right? So yeah, of course, there are some situations in which the ratings are really, really bad, but for an average shop, it's really quite good. Now, do we really believe it? Well, it might be. It might be that all shops are super excellent and there's nothing wrong with this way of evaluating performance. However, how about external validity? What is it that we learn from this performance assessment exercise that we could relate to the actual commercial performance of the shops that are being evaluated? And here are the correlations between these mystery shopping scores for a particular shop and the sales that these shops generate. And as you can see, these correlations are all about zero. They're not the only sort of trying to be significant correlation is the correlation between sales and the presence of fresh bread. Yeah, if you have more fresh bread, you have higher sales because people would rather buy something hot and crispy than something that is soggy and yesterday made. That makes sense. But if you look at cleanliness, if you look at friendliness of customer service, if you look at the overall impression, there's nothing going on. So you do measure something. You do measure something. The shops do vary in terms of these characteristics. However, the information that you measure, the performance performance indicators that you measure, it's not clear what they mean for financial performance of the store in question. So what is it that you measure is not really clear at all. Now, a further analysis, it's not part of this course, but you know, I will spare some thoughts with you. A further analysis of this data reveals a very interesting story there. The story is, the most important factor that determines a mystery shopping score is not the characteristics of the shop. No. The most important factor that determines the mystery shopper's score is the identity of the mystery shopper. Whether it's a man or woman, whether the age, whether it's a local resident or someone who had to travel to carry out this mystery shopping exercise, right? And you can tell a lot of interesting anecdotes based on these insights, which are totally outside of this course. But the point is, what is relevant to this course is that this is an initiative, a practice which is quite expensive, which is run by many, many retail organizations in the world, but not all organizations are actually doing it right, in the sense that they, you know, and one mistake that some organizations make is not giving behavioral descriptions to subjective performance criteria, largely subjective performance criteria that they use in order to evaluate and promote their employees. So basically, you know, look at this shop, which was found to be super dirty. The shop manager, chances are the shop manager has been fired. Was this firing justified? Maybe. The shop manager in the shop that would get, for instance, 50 for Sauberkeit, for the cleanliness, right, would probably most likely not get their bonus in the month when this assessment was made. Is this justified? Maybe this shop has generated quite a lot of sales in that month. After all, you see there's no correlation between sales and cleanliness of the shop. So you make very important HR decisions based on very unreliable and noisy source of information. One way to make it less noisy and more reliable is to introduce behaviorally anchored rating scale, which has been done in case of the shoe shops and has not been done in case of the bakeries. Now, here's another example of how subjective performance evaluation can go wrong. This is a master thesis by my friend Matthias Heinz from the University of Cologne, is also my co-author. So he did his master thesis using the data from a bank in Frankfurt. And this bank had a front office where customers would come and be served by the front office workers, and it had a back office, right? So, and what the back office did was the administrative support of the front office activities. And the bank had a clear bonus plan which was based on performance evaluation, a usual story in many, many, many organizations. Now, look here. This is the performance evaluation of the front office. Now, these are the super good employees, these are the super bad employees, right? And as you can see, there's quite a lot of variation in the performance ratings given to the employees in the front office. This is a distribution of performance evaluations of the back office. What do you see as a difference? What do you see as a difference, and what can you make of it? Right? Well, one difference that you see, and you see it quite clearly, is that when you look at the front office, there is a cluster of the workers who are not doing all that well in terms of performance indicators, in terms of their performance evaluation. When you look at the back office workers, there's no one, virtually no one, doing badly. Everybody is doing good or super good. Sounds a bit fishy to me, right? So you could think, okay, this bank has a great back office. You know, everybody's really doing fantastic there. And it has more heterogeneous front office, right? It could be that for some reason the front office workers are really worse than the back office workers. Could be. But a more likely reason, and later and in his thesis he provides some additional indicators for this to be the case, is that, well, workers in the front office and the workers in the back office in that bank were evaluated according to different sets of criteria. And in particular, the workers in the front office were evaluated on the criteria, many of which were objectively measured. For example, the number of customers and the number of bank accounts that they were measuring. This is easy to calculate. Whereas the workers in the back office, because they didn't do with customers, they didn't do with accounts, they provided sort of organizational and administrative support to front office activities, their performance were evaluated on more subjective, fuzzy, not behaviorally anchored indicators. Now, when it's easy to calculate the number of accounts opened and the number of customers served per employee, you see this variation and it's meaningful. It tells you that these people have few accounts and these people have many accounts. And the bank earns money partly from administering customer accounts, so this performance indicator is meaningful. It's objectively measured and it's related to, at the end of the day, how much money the bank will earn, right? So you can reward and promote people based on this performance indicator, and these decisions will in the end result in better performance results of the bank, because, you know, if you incentivize people towards doing things that in the end will result in more money, that's great. That's what firms do, right? However, if you start promoting people based on the performance indicators from the back office, it's not clear. Unfortunately, there's no correlation reported between the performance of the back office workers and the performance of the bank, largely because, you know, it's very hard to relate the performance of back office workers to the amount of money that the bank is earning. But the point is, you know, if everybody is super good, and if you have a certain amount of money that you want to deliver, that you want to distribute as bonuses to the workers in the bank, how do you decide this? The bank had a practice of allocating a certain amount of money as employee bonus, and then people would get shares in this bonus based on their performance evaluation results. Now look here, these guys will get a lot of bonus because their performance ratings are very high. These guys, the front office guys, who generate basically the cash for the bank, some of them will not get a bonus, others will get a bonus, and very few people will get as much bonus as the people in the back office. Now, a number of interesting questions. Is it justified? Is it really a fair reflection of individual contributions to the bank performance? Could be, but something tells me that it has more to do with the imperfections of performance measurement rather than with the objective differences in the amount and importance of contribution that individual workers make to the performance of this particular bank. So you have to have behaviorally anchored rating scales if you evaluate performance along subjective criteria. Now let's move on to the raters, right? So we've looked at the rating and ranking. Now let's look at the raters. Who do you select as raters? Now, a catchword in the current HR practices is 360-degree feedback. It's like balanced scorecard when we talk about performance indicators. Now, when we talk about the raters, when we talk about the individuals who will be in charge of performance evaluation, we talk about 360-degree feedback. That's the most fashionable way to do performance evaluation. And what this 360-degree feedback is really saying is that you should seek input into performance evaluation from the different stakeholders in the organization. So you should, in order to evaluate a particular employee, so here's an employee in the organization, Nick, professor of organizational economics at the University of Constance. You want to evaluate his performance. You have to ask his supervisors about, you know, rank Nick's or rate Nick's performance according to the following scales, and here are the bars for you. You also have to ask Nick's subordinates, the assistants that work at Nick's chair, to reflect on Nick's performance. You also have to ask Nick's customers, the students, to evaluate Nick's performance, and this is routinely done. You may want to ask Nick himself to evaluate his performance. In fact, many of the, quite a lot of performance evaluation forms, quite a lot of performance evaluation practices, and quite a lot of examples shown in this lecture are asking individuals themselves to evaluate their performance. And you also may want to contact Nick's colleagues, peers, the people at the same level of organizational hierarchy within the University of Konstanz. So now this is the idea of the 360 degree feedback. You seek information about performance not from one particular source, but from the multitude of sources. And why is this such a great idea? Why is this such a great idea? Well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, if you're dealing with performance evaluation, this is largely a subjective business. And if you have information coming from one particular evaluator or evaluators, coming from one particular source, this information could have a bias which reflects the specific angle at which people look at this individual. Nick can be a great researcher, and so his superiors and colleagues would give him very high ratings for his research activities. But students don't care about Nick's research, let's face it, right? You don't care about my research, do you? And so what you care about is how good I am as a teacher, because that's what you're here to do, right? Is to learn from the professors at the University of Konstanz. So if you want to get a fuller picture of Nick's contribution to the success of the University of Konstanz, you have to have information about the various aspects of Nick's performance. That's the informativeness principle. And it turns out that different stakeholders within an organization will have relatively better information about particular aspects of Nick's performance. So if you want to have more complete information about the multifaceted contribution that Nick makes to the University of Konstanz, an excellent way to do so is to ask the people who have the best information about particular aspect of Nick's contribution to the University of Konstanz. So that's really the idea and the justification of using 360 degree feedback in the business of performance evaluation. Now, most of the times, you don't use 360 degree feedback, you use what I jokingly call 90 degree or 180 degree feedback. Because you don't, it's very expensive to contact all these stakeholders. It's very expensive to get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different batches of performance outcomes rated by various individuals for one particular employee, right? It's very expensive, it's quite a lot of information. And yes, we live in the world of big data where evaluation can be done very, very easily online, but it's still a burden. It's still a burden on the time and effort of the various people within an organization. So it's expensive. And the full 360 degree feedback is used, therefore, for relatively senior members of organization whose contribution to the firm is more pivotal, whose incentives tend to be sharper, and for whom the costs of this evaluation relative to the difference in performance that they can deliver to the organization are relatively small. Now, for more junior employees, you do this incomplete 360 degree feedback by asking them to evaluate performance themselves and also maybe asking their superiors to evaluate their performance. You don't worry about customers, you don't worry about colleagues, because that's additional information which requires time and money to collect. Now, so we also mentioned when we talked about choosing the right raters, we also mentioned the need to understand the complex cognitive processes that are at work when people analyze information from the outside world and convert this information into a particular performance rating or ranking. And there are all sorts of biases involved in this process. And some of these biases are depicted here in this table. So these are the biases or errors in the language of the textbook from which I took this table. It's Gerhardt and Ryan's textbook on compensation. So these are the various psychological biases that affect people's performance evaluations, right? So it's quite independent of the actual performance outcome, which is unobserved, which is what we're trying to measure. These are the systematic biases that differ by individuals that also enter performance evaluation results and muddy them up. So this is the halo error. If you like one particular aspect of performance of a particular individual, if you like them, right, you will tend to rate their performance all of their performance indicators highly. There's the horn error, which is the opposite of halo error. I had students who really didn't like the way I taught. And they also gave me really bad grades for the opportunity to ask questions, even though I always gave opportunities to ask questions. They just don't like me. So why don't you just put 5 on every aspect of Nick's performance? It's easy after all. All right. So these are the halo and horn errors. There's first impression error and recency error. These are the biases that have to do with the impressions of particular individuals' work that the evaluators got either in the beginning of their acquaintance or more recently. So hence the first impression versus recency error. There is leniency error and severity error. So leniency error is, I have to tick the boxes on, I have to evaluate the performance of this particular individual, but you know, I find it hard to evaluate this performance because I know very little about customer service. I'm not sure. I don't have behavioral descriptions of various rating scales. So if I'm a nice guy, I will give the highest or nearly highest grade for every aspect of performance without much thinking about it because, you know, I'm a nice guy. I can be an evil guy. I can really be a sort of frustrated, misanthropic, student-hating professor or whoever, right? And if I get to evaluate somebody's performance, I would give bad grades overall just because I think it's a waste of time and I want to stop this practice or whatever. So these are the errors which shift the distribution of performance grades to the extremes. Either everybody is super good or everybody is super bad. Now, there is another bias, which is called central tendency error. The central tendency error is when, again, you don't have clear behavioral descriptions of the particular rating scales. So what you do is I will tick average everywhere. I'll tick average. It's, you know, when you get to evaluate somebody, you think, one is too generous. You know, one is extreme. Let me give 2. Or 5 is extreme, even if this worker is totally useless, right, and you want them gone, that's too harsh, so let's give them 4 or 3, right? Again, in the absence of behavioral anchors to rating scales, these errors are very, very likely to be made. So there's clone error and spillover error that I will skip because we've got other stuff to do. Now, the last little chapter of today's lecture, let's talk about ways to try to eliminate the subjective biases and noise in subjective performance in the business of subjective performance evaluation. And that brings us to the idea of ranking. So, rating and ranking. Remember the difference? Rating is you rate on the absolute scale. Ranking is you always rate in comparison with someone. And when you do ranking, the advantage of ranking is that you cancel quite a lot of noise and bias that is unfortunately involved in the business of performance evaluation. So ranking was at some point, still is in some organizations like Amazon, but it used to be very, very, very popular. And here is a very sort of textbook popular example of the so-called rank and yank practice, which used to be practiced in a firm called General Electric. You know this, General Electric, yeah, a very large U.S. firm. So what they did? They ranked people, not rated. They ranked people in terms of performance. So they had top X percent, they had bottom X percent, they had the middle Z percent, right? And then they thought, okay, let us fire the people who belong to the bottom X percent and hire new ones in the hope that we can draw better people from the newly hired people. Now, of course, not everybody of them will be super good, but some will be super good, and those who are not good enough, we will fire next year. So that's the essence of the rank and yank practice. It's pretty harsh, right? But from the theory point of view, it actually makes sense. From some pure mathematical argument, it should make sense. So you always, by doing so, you always improve the quality of your workforce, and you achieve higher precision in performance ranking by filtering out some of the noise that is common to all employees or to a particular evaluator who does the evaluation. Now, this practice is now stopped. General Electric stopped this practice in 2016. And here's the article from the Wall Street Journal that I learned about it from. And why did this rank and yank practice? Why this super strong belief in the virtues of ranking and making quite harsh HR decisions based on the ranking information? Why has it largely died out? Because it has some unfortunate consequences for organizational performance, which have only recently been realized and detected empirically. Now, one consequence, which may seem obvious, but it didn't seem obvious to the people at the time, one consequence is that, yes, forced ranking improves the average performance of improves the average quality of workforce in your organization. Yes, that's the case. However, if you have a particular distribution of workforce in the country or in the world, and if you do rank and yank every year, then the marginal increase in the average performance of your workforce goes down and down and down, right? Because you're moving closer and closer and closer to the frontier of the distribution of the workforce quality, right? If you end up hiring all Nobel Prize winners as your workforce through rank and yank practice, come next year, and some of the Nobel Prize winners who you've hired to work for you will end up in the bottom X percent of the distribution just by the virtue of the forced ranking practice. Are you going to fire these people? And will it be a wise decision? You may want to fire these people, sure. Then you will hire somebody from the outside, but it's not clear that the people coming from the outside will be on average better than the bottom X percent of the people who you fired. So the marginal benefits of the forced ranking, they really decrease with time as organizations hire better and better and better workforce. That's one sort of observation about forced ranking. What's the problem there? The problem is that, well, the forced ranking has benefits and costs. The benefits of forced ranking decrease. The marginal benefits of forced ranking decrease. The costs of forced ranking remain the same or even increase. What is the cost of forced ranking? Well, there are two items on the cost side of the balance. First is that there is a forced ranking creates a competitive culture within the organization. If you know that you are going to be ranked against your teammates, and if you are unfortunate enough to be in the bottom X percent next year, you'll be fired. Think about, suppose you are somewhere in the sort of second half of the distribution of performance in your firm, and there is a non-zero chance that you will be fired. Will you be interested in cooperation? Will you be interested in helping people in your team? Will you be interested in providing public services for organization, or will you only be interested in doing things that will make you individually look good relative to the rest of your team? So the least thing you could do is not to cooperate. Some people may actually resort to sabotage. So, and again, you know, the sort of culture it creates within the team is not likely to be the ideal culture that firms want to foster. So you have this decreasing benefits of rank and yank and increasing costs of rank and yank. And at some point, the benefits of rank and yank are actually lower than the cost of rank and yank. And at this point, the system should really be stopped. And it did stop. It did stop. Now, does it mean that we should not rank? Well, if I were an HR consultant in organizations, I would strongly advocate the use of ratings rather than rankings, but I would strongly anchor the ratings behaviorally. I would make sure that people have a very clear idea about what each rating grade means. That is, I think, the best thing we can do when it comes to rating. Now, I am not an HR consultant at General Electric or Google or Amazon. And in fact, there are a couple of firms, for instance, Microsoft, that still practice elements of the forced ranking system, right? So they still practice it. This information is a little bit dated because even though I was trying to find the most recent information, this is as recent as I found it. Now, what are the advantages? Well, why is this still being practiced? Well, there's one advantage of forced ranking that is hard to emulate by other practices. And this advantage is, if your baseline performance level is bad, if you've come to an organization that is not performing very well, if there's a lot of slack, if the employment conditions are too cozy to keep a lot of useless people on, one quick way of getting rid of the slack is to do forced ranking. So forced ranking can be effective in the short run and in times of organizational change and restructuring. If you really want to jack up the performance of your firm in really short run, if you are really under stress and need to restructure or die, forced ranking may be an option. But as a long-run practice, it's not advocated. Now, what are the alternatives to ranking? What are the emerging best practices in performance evaluation? I don't have much time to discuss them in detail, which is a shame, but just a few words. Generally, performance evaluation has become less evaluative. Performance evaluation has become less discriminating, less sort of about giving a performance grade on which promotion and other important decisions are based. It has evolved more into the system of giving feedback. So performance evaluation with career implications has evolved into feedback giving system with some career implications, but less clear career implications. So that the reality of performance evaluation practices has become much more complex. Now, one thing that one sees when one talks to HR directors and reads HR literature is that, the relationship between the level of performance and the level of pay is history. So the textbooks, all these models that we've studied are mathematically elegant, but they reflect the reality less and less. So maybe in a couple of years' time, I'll have to rewrite this course. What is the new model that emerges, the new model in the current HR practice, is the model which relates changes in pay to changes in performance. Notice the difference. Level to level, change to change. Mathematically, no equivalence, because this is more, well, there is some relationship between the two, of course, but this new system emphasized the dynamic aspects of performance and pay much more than the static system, where the level of pay depends on the level of performance. There is a lot of big data and IT capacity involved in the business of providing feedback. That's another good practice, which basically allows you to increase the number of raters and increase the number of items against which performance can be evaluated, which is good according to informativeness principle. And there is quite a lot of development on the psychological and ethical side of the business of providing feedback that I simply have no time to describe in detail and have to stop now. So thanks. See you next week.